Welcome to Words of Grace, radio ministry of Elder Ben Winslet, pastor of the Flint River Primitive Baptist Church near Huntsville, Alabama. We invite you to stay tuned to today's broadcast.
Our broadcast today is entitled A Lesson on Giving. Today we continue our recent series on the Sermon on the Mount, coming to the first lesson of Matthew chapter 6, which deals with the subject of alms, almsgiving, and giving alms. This finds itself in a teaching on three forms of righteous behavior, specifically giving, praying, and fasting. Now, the word alms and almsgiving, this word alms is an interesting one. In this form, alms, it's a shortened version of the Old English counterpart from which it was derived. That Old English word came from and sounded very similar to the Christian Latin word for almsgiving. And that Latin word came from the Greek word that we actually find in the Greek New Testament, the text that underlies our English Bibles. So that's a little bit of interesting trivia and maybe also a little bit of a compelling case to keep this word alms in our vocabulary and our Bible translations. It literally comes from the original language through Latin and Old English. The word alms in Scripture has reference to giving, and we probably all knew that. We all know that that has reference to someone giving money, assistance, to someone who is less fortunate than them. So this would be a form of mercy, and it would be giving in benevolence. This particular teaching that we consider today, Jesus' instruction on alms and giving money to those that are less fortunate to us, this highlights how we're to go about giving, and Jesus would include several examples on how not to give in this passage. Before we get into the specifics of almsgiving, I want to mention something worth noticing from the New Testament. If you do a concordance search for the word alms, you notice very quickly that it only occurs in a Jewish setting, and that was peculiar to me. Jesus teaches on it here in the Sermon on the Mount to a Jewish audience. This is still technically in the Old Testament time period in the sense that Jesus hadn't gone to the cross yet and fulfilled the law. His audience was a Jewish audience. These are people who kept the law and lived in accordance with the Old Testament. You find this word alms throughout the four Gospels, and then you find it in Jewish settings in the New Testament in the book of Acts, particularly people asking for alms at the temple. Cornelius, a Gentile, was one that gave alms, but he was a God-fearer, a person who was a Gentile, who was a worshiper of the God of the Old Testament. Now, when I learned that this word alms was used in a Jewish context, and it wasn't the word used for New Testament giving in the epistles of Paul or Peter or any other writer, I was a little intrigued by that. I was a little surprised. The words in the epistles for giving and support of those that are less fortunate were commonly words like the Greek words for fellowship, grace, gift, and blessing. Now, am I telling you that there's some great theological mystery revealed in the different words that are used? No, I'm not telling you that at all, but I am saying that this is a word that primarily found itself in Jewish audiences in Jesus' day. Perhaps the teaching of Christ here on almsgiving exposed how the nation of Israel was going about doing things such as this for a show. Maybe, and this is conjecture, maybe the Christians wanted to use a different word, a word that better fit the message of grace and salvation that didn't have the connotation on it that this word has because of the misuse of giving, as Jesus would correct here in Matthew chapter 6. As we'll unpack that in just a moment, you'll see very quickly that the powers that be, the Pharisees, many of the Jews, the wealthy, they went about giving alms to be seen of men, and as Jesus said, verily they have their reward. They wanted to be glorified by men, and so they were glorified by men as they gave and made a public spectacle out of it. Now, another point that I want to make, one that's very worth considering, is almsgiving is based on mercy or compassion. And in an Old Testament context, this would be giving above and beyond what the law actually prescribed, that is to say, what the law would have as non-negotiable. As far as the New Testament is concerned, we're instructed to give. We're told to give cheerfully. We're told that it's more blessed to give than to receive. We're to give to our local assemblies for the upkeep of the grounds and the facility, for the expansion of the grounds or the facility if it calls for it, the renovation if it calls for it, if we have a greater need for more space. Whatever the requirements are, we're to support our local assemblies in that regard. And we're especially to give for the ministry of the gospel. That is to say, we are to utilize our money to further the cause of Christ in the world. That can look like the support of the local pastor or the ministers who are laboring in a congregation and taking the word to the community. But this also looks like paying for live stream equipment and paying for radio time, upkeeping the church's website and podcasts and YouTube channels and things such as that. And so we have the great privilege and blessing as New Testament Christians of giving to our local assemblies for the support of the ministry of the gospel. We take the word of God and we share it with the means that we have. And I'm thankful to be in a congregation where we're very forward thinking in that regards. We love to publish all sorts of contents. We believe very strongly that the gospel is to be preached. And I'm thankful for a congregation that wants to support those forms of outreach in our community and in the world itself. Another thing that we as New Testament Christians are to give to support is the poor. Paul said in Galatians chapter 2, to remember the poor. Certainly we have an obligation to God to care for those who are downcast. We read in James chapter 1 that pure religion is to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. We are to do good unto all men, according to Galatians, especially those of the household of faith. And so we are to care for people both within and outside of the church who are downcast and have need. Paul actually taught to Timothy in 1 Timothy 5 that widows are to be taken under the financial care of the church. Widows are to be provided for by the church in a financial sense? Absolutely. If they're destitute, that is to say they're poor, and they have no family who can help take care of them, it is the church's responsibility and privilege to care for widows who are widows indeed. Now, as individuals, there are plenty of organizations that we can support aside from our local assemblies. One of my personal favorites is our local homeless shelter, the Downtown Rescue Mission. Organizations that take care of people who are struggling, those are great things that we can contribute to financially. There are many Christian organizations in our town, such as food banks or organizations like Graces of Gurley that provides all sorts of things for children. And then you have larger ones such as Samaritan's Purse or Children's Hunger Fund. I love to support those organizations. They use the money wisely and responsibly. Nobody's heading up those charities as a way of becoming wealthy, and they really do a great job in helping people. Samaritan's Purse is one of the first organizations with boots on the ground, with support anytime there's a natural disaster here in our country or around the world. Either way, as Christians, we're definitely to be giving people, and this teaching of Christ that we consider today most certainly applies to us. So as we think about alms, this would be compassion and mercy above and beyond that which was required of them in the law. After all, it's mercy and not duty. So let's take a brief look at the required giving that Israelites were to do in support of the downcast. Now, as we introduce this thought to you, we remind you that the law is often broken into three sections or categories. While this distinction isn't made in the Bible, it's also not to be completely disregarded, and so because of that, commentators, theologians, and pastors and preachers all through church history have used various forms of this language. The law in the Old Testament is divided in our minds into civil, ceremonial, and moral. Now, the moral law would be your Ten Commandment type laws: not to murder, not to commit adultery, not to covet, not to lie. Ceremonial would be things such as how to build the Ark of the Covenant, how to build the tabernacle, what type of animals are to be offered, who the priests are supposed to be, what the priests are supposed to be wearing, and also things such as ceremonial cleanness and uncleanness. If you touch a dead thing, if you're sick, if you have a baby, if you have one issue or another, well, you're ceremonially unclean for a period of time and you have to many times wash yourself with running water. Those are ceremonial laws. Civil laws would be things such as repaying people for damages. It includes the eye for an eye penalties that we recently talked about in this series that ensured equity and justice. But interestingly enough, grouped here in the civil laws are also things such as the care for the poor, which included a taxation system that the children of Israel were to participate in. It was non-negotiable, much like our taxes are non-negotiable, and this is what we refer to as the tithe. Now, the word tithe means tenth, and I'll say up front that tithing in the New Testament is not an explicit command. It is referred to in the New Testament, but only in making references to things that happened in the Old Testament. Or perhaps when Jesus would criticize people that paid tithes and bragged about it, but omitted the weightier matters of the law, like mercy. They obviously were giving money, but at the same time, they had no mercy or love in their heart when they did. And he said, "You were right for doing what you did, but you shouldn't have omitted these weightier matters of the law. You should be doing all of the above." But as far as a New Testament example or command where Christians or church members were tithing, that is to say giving 10% of their income or their produce or their wine, that which the Old Testament actually prescribed, there's not a New Testament command to do this. Sometimes it's debated, and I will leave that debate with you because that's not our subject for today. But in the Old Testament law, there were actually three tithes that the nation of Israel was to observe. One was to go to the Levites, and this tithe was annual. It was a yearly tithe that supported the Levites. Who were the Levites again? Well, that was the tribe that the priesthood came from. The Levites received no land inheritance in the Old Testament. Their inheritance was the Lord. And so instead of getting land, they were to be supported by the rest of the tribes of Israel. Did the nation of Israel always support the Levites the way they should? No. There is one reference to the great shame that the Levites had returned unto their own fields instead of being provided for by the nation of Israel. And there's a reference in Malachi where God says, "Bring the tithes to my house that my storehouse might be full, and well, I'll pour a blessing out upon you that you don't have room to receive if you would only obey and bring the tithes and offerings to God's house that God has prescribed that God deserved back in the Old Testament, what he had called for." The tithes that were to go to the Levites provided for that tribe, and out of that tribe, many of them were priests. Not all of them, but certainly some of them were. They were to labor from 25 to 50, but throughout their entire lives, they were to be provided for through the tithe. This would be 10% of that which they grew, 10% of their wine. They were to bring it, and that was the supply that the Levites would live off of. You also had the festival tithe. This was so people could eat and rejoice before God in their feast travels, their festival travels to Jerusalem. You had three a year where the nation of Israel always gathered back in Jerusalem, and this was for the support of those festival days. And then every 3 years, you had what is called a poor tithe. Every 3 years, another 10% of what they had grown was to be brought and distributed to those that are impoverished. And generally, when the Bible in the Old Testament lists the impoverished people, the downcast, you would have, of course, the poor, but specifically you have subgroups like the widows and the fatherless, sometimes even the stranger, which would be non-Israelites who are in Jerusalem. Foreigners, if you will, they were also to be supported sometimes by the care for the poor in that day. Now, another form of support for the poor came not from the tithe that was to be done, but in each locale, and this would probably be a much more effective way of caring for the poor in each different corner of the nation of Israel, pun intended, they were to leave the corners of their fields ungleaned, unharvested. You find this in Leviticus 19, 9 and 10, Leviticus 23, 22, and Deuteronomy 24, 19. Specifically, what they were to do, if they planted their field, they were not allowed to harvest the corners of the field. Now, they were to plow that land, they were to plant on that land, they were to tend to that land, but they were not to harvest it. And this is explicitly left for the poor, the fatherless, the widow, and even the stranger. Secondly, if things had fallen off of plants, if it gleaned and landed on the ground and was just laying there, they were also not to pick it up and carry it into their storehouses. But that which is left on the ground was also for the support of the poor. And we find that famously come into the narrative of the book of Ruth. Do you remember what Boaz left for Ruth as she was harvesting? He left handfuls of purpose. He put little handfuls of food on the ground that she could legally come and take, and he did it on purpose to care for her. And then lastly, according to Deuteronomy 24, if you leave some sheaves accidentally out in the field, if you forget about them, you can't go back and get them, but they are to be left there as well for the fatherless, the widow, the poor, etc. So God had many mandatory systems of caring for the poor in the Old Testament. You might call these compulsory. And the giving of alms, that's giving above and beyond what you're required to do in the tithes and in the ungleaned corners of your field. Now, here's a huge question. Did the nation of Israel actually ever do these things? I'm sure it happened some, but there's hardly a shred of evidence that they did, which includes other things too. Every seventh year in the nation of Israel was to be a Sabbath where even servants got rest and the land is to be left at rest. They never observed those. And every seventh Sabbath year was the year of Jubilees, where they were to allow all of the debts to be forgiven. They were to let every slave go free in the nation of Israel. It was to be a time that depicted really the salvation that Christ has brought us like no other time. And there isn't one single reference to them observing that in the entire Old Testament. But there's actually a reference in Jeremiah of slaves being rounded back up after they were let go. So the nation of Israel never obeyed this the way that God would have them to do it. The prophets actually condemned Israel for their disobedience here. Isaiah 1:23 says, "Thy princes are rebellious. They judge not the fatherless, neither doth the cause of the widow come unto them." Jeremiah 5 says, "They judge not the cause of the fatherless, yet they prosper, and the right of the needy do they not judge." Notice that word right there. What rights did the needy have? Well, they had the right to the corners of the field. They had the right to 10% every 3 years of what other people harvested in Israel. Those were rights, just as much as your First Amendment right, or Second Amendment right, or Fourth Amendment right, or Fifth Amendment right. As those are your rights in the Bill of Rights as Americans, they didn't stand up for the rights of the needy. Amos 5, verses 11 and 12, "For as much, therefore, as your treading is upon the poor, they afflict the just, they take a bribe, they turn aside the poor in the gate from their right, Amos actually says that they sell the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. How did they degrade human life so as to sell the poor for a pair of shoes? Malachi 3:5, I will come near to you in judgment against those that oppress the hireling in his wages, the widow, and the fatherless. Hireling there doesn't mean like we commonly use it in modern Christianity. That would be a preacher who only preaches for the money, but he really isn't a true God-called preacher, and he changes what he preaches depending on the audience to have the greatest financial benefit. A hireling simply means someone who is hired to do a job. So oppressing the hireling would be like hiring a man to paint your house and then not paying him his wages when he is done. But they oppressed also the widow and the fatherless. Now back to Matthew chapter 6. What is Jesus teaching concerning giving alms? That is to say, what is above and beyond what is commanded when we are merciful to people? The main point that Jesus makes here, summarized, is to be very private and quiet about our giving. Have you ever noticed philanthropists tend to herald their giving? Some do it for the tax break, but others like to be recognized, and you see things from banners to buildings named after people who give significant amounts of money to any sort of cause in the world. Is that sort of thing consistent with the teachings of Christ? No, not at all. It is inconsistent with the teaching of Christ. And again, this has reference to this teaching, something that was occurring in the context of the nation of Israel, but we can apply this directly to the way we give money to good causes even today. Let's read Matthew 6, verses 1 through 4. Take heed that you do not your alms before men to be seen of them. Otherwise, you have no reward of your Father, which is in heaven. Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But when thou doest alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth, that thine alms may be in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret himself shall reward thee openly. Verse 1, when you give alms. Take heed means, take heed that you do not your alms before men. Take heed means to pay careful attention. Take notice. Be intentional. Be careful then not to give your alms in front of others, and especially don't do this to be seen of others. And both points are implied there. Be private and don't be intentionally obvious for the sake of glorifying yourself. Now, such would render us without the reward of God, the reward that God would give us for being generous. And I would insist that the reward here is not eternal glory, but something that God blesses us with in this world, because we are not, hear me very carefully, we are not saved by things that we do. But there are rewards that God gives His obedient children in this life. He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him, and these are often blessings in a spiritual sense. There's a lot of people who carrot and stick, as it were, God's people. They hold out a carrot in front of a rabbit on a stick, saying, if you'll give money to our church, God will bless you with even more money than you already have. And certainly sometimes that's probably been true, where God has blessed generous people with greater finances because they were good stewards of what He had given them to start with. But many of the blessings that God gives us are spiritual. Now, this thought of depriving ourselves of God's reward by trying to be glorified of men is a point that would be repeated throughout this portion of the Sermon on the Mount. We're to be Christians in private, and by that I don't mean closet Christians. We're to be Christians in private, that is to say, we're to be Christians when no one is looking, in private as in public, and even more so in private than in public. And in serving God in secret, God will bless us openly. This is in stark contrast to the Pharisees and other religious elitists of Jesus' day who liked to be in the spotlight for their religiosity. Does this indicate maybe the way American churches have collected funds is on dangerous ground biblically? Well, likely so. But that's common with a lot of what American churches do. Sometimes we wouldn't know what biblical looks like if it were standing right in front of us in this country. Passing a plate, as has been popularized in American churches, does actually create some risk of making a show out of giving. Another practice my particular order of faith has commonly practiced is to put a plate on the table instead of passing it, and everyone passes by and puts their gift on the plate when they walk by it. That's not much better and may actually be worse, because you then have a massive pile of cash on a plate on the communion table. The more historic practice is actually to put a box somewhere in the facility where folks can discreetly place their gift for the church, and that's actually our practice here. And of course, in our day of the internet, online giving offers a very private way to support your local church or other organizations you feel burdened to help. Verse 2, "Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee." Sounding a trumpet is one example of what not to be like in giving. Some speculate that this could have been done by loudly banging your coin in the treasury, in the synagogue, or the temple. But being that a trumpet is a wind instrument that makes a loud noise, and it was used for signaling in Jesus' day, it's more likely that he's saying not to announce and make a show of your giving. Notice people would do this in this verse in the synagogue and in the streets. So don't herald your giving. Don't trumpet your giving in public. Notice if they did that, they receive glory from men, and that glory is their reward. They get exactly what they're wanting. In other words, they get attention. And I would just tell you that attention is far inferior to the blessings that God can give us when we are obedient in private. The solution and the practical application of this Jesus gives us in verse 3, "But when thou doest alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth." Is that literally saying to hide one hand in your pocket if you give money with the other? No, what he's saying is not to desire attention. That's always a risk we have when we do something good. Our sinful nature hijacks the good that we do. As Paul said, "Even when I do good, evil is present with me." And so we're to be intentionally private about the good things that we might do. We don't let anyone else know what we're doing. We're secretive in the way that we bless others. And as we see in verse 4, if we do that, there's open blessings for us in our lives, "that thy Father which seeth in secret himself shall reward thee openly." Now, we don't give so that God blesses us. That would also have some sinfulness to it. We would be covetous if we gave just because we wanted God to give us some great blessing. We're to give because we love people. Again, this word alms has reference to mercy and compassion. But when we give, we are to do it in secret, secretly, and God will most certainly bless us in ways that are very obvious. I hope and pray in our day of financial blessing for some and financial sufferings for others, that we would be people who champion the cause of giving alms, or as the epistles would put it, grace, gifts, fellowship, and blessing. That we would be people who remember the poor, people who do good unto all men, especially the household of faith. That we would bless those that are around us as privately as we can. And our God who sees all will bless us openly. Again, I'm Ben Winslet, thanking you for listening to Words of Grace today, inviting you to write and let me know that you've received today's broadcast, and also to tune in again next week at this time. Until then, may the Lord's richest blessings be yours, is my prayer.
If you enjoy the messages you hear on Words of Grace, consider this your invitation to visit a Primitive Baptist church in your community. Address your correspondence to Words of Grace Radio, 641 Moontown Road, Brownsboro, Alabama 35741, or visit us online at flintriverpbc.org.